Support for KNKX comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, serving high net worth families, individuals, foundations, and endowments since 1967, with a philosophy that life is as much about goals and aspirations as it is about maximizing financial capital. More at LairdNortonWM.com.
Today, the Big Apple hits Jet City. The Spike Willner Quartet is here. Mr. Willner studied jazz at the New School in New York in the mid-80s. The great pianist Walter Davis Jr. was one of his first teachers there. He's established himself as a favorite in New York City, most often found playing at Smalls, a 60-seat club in Greenwich Village he took over just about a decade ago. They've archived every show since at smallslive.com. He's also opened the jazz club Mesro next door just a few years ago. He has a lifelong love of ragtime and early jazz, but that's just the beginning of his musical perspective. Spike Willner is playing with a wonderful band that's here in the KNKX studios. Joe Magnarelli on trumpet, Paul Gill bass, Anthony Pinciotti's behind the drums. Please welcome the Spike Willner Quartet. Thank you. The Spike Wilner Quartet live on 88.5 KNKX. That's Joe Magnarelli at the trumpet, Paul Gill bass, and Anthony Pinciotti at the drums. Spike, my introduction was awfully brief. Could you tell us a little bit more about the band you've brought to Seattle?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for having us here. What a wonderful studio. And all of these musicians are musicians that I've played with basically my entire adult life. And we've, in different configurations, have played together in different jobs throughout our careers. Joe Magnarelli is a guy that we played together in a band called Planet Jazz years ago, led by a drummer named Johnny Ellis, who is unfortunately deceased, but wrote some great tunes. And that very first tune that we played is called Radio, named for the Felix the Cat character that always went, Radio! Right? And so that was from Planet Jazz. So I always like to play, maybe tip a hat to one of my dearly departed friends, and also one that we all knew well. And then Paul Gill and I have played for years in the band of Lenny Kuje, legendary vibraphonist from Washington, D.C. Anthony Pinciotti and I have also worked together in my own trios and various configurations of my own bands. And, well, he's one of the highest regarded drummers in the city. So I managed to somehow convince these guys to get on a plane with me and come out to have a great time. No, we love the West Coast. It's fantastic here.
It's wonderful to have you here. So speaking a bit about the players you've worked with your adult life, I want to go back to your childhood. One of your first public performances, barely a teenager, and you got on stage and were playing some Scott Joplin music. And I wonder if you could tell us about your early attraction to jazz and particularly that style of piano jazz.
I started piano very, very young with a neighborhood piano teacher. And there was a television show on when I was a kid about Scott Joplin, starring Billy Dee Williams. And I remember seeing that. I must have been in the second grade or something. I saw that show on TV and it blew my mind. For whatever reason, it just resonated with me and I fell in love with that. That was a time when, like, the Sting had just come out and there all the ragtime revival thing was happening. So I got involved in ragtime piano. It was my first love. And then that carried kind of with me through my career. But when I started my freshman year at college in New York City at the New School Jazz Department, that was a bebop town, and I just got immersed in that language at that point. So,
and eventually coming back and reclaiming that, I think one of your mentors, Jackie Byard, was talking to you about how important that music was.
The ragtime, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, there was one incident where I went to hear Jackie, who was, by the way, a phenomenal stride pianist, traditional player, and also one of the best free avant-garde players. He played in Mingus, Eric Dolphy. So he really had his feet in both worlds and proved to me, and it was something that I've carried through my own career, just the importance of being rooted in what the forefathers of jazz piano put together, because it's important. And then at the same time, not be trapped by the tradition so that you can't find your own voice wherever that might be. But one time he was playing at Birdland, the older Birdland, not the original Birdland, of course, but the one that used to be near Smoke Jazz Club uptown. And he saw me in the audience and he said, man, come up here and play some ragtime for these guys. And I was just like, what? I couldn't believe it. It was an audience full of people, you know. And he said, just do it. Play the Maple Leaf Rag. I know you can do that. And I was thinking maybe I'd have to play some other jazz. Play Maple Leaf Rag. Play it. Well, so I did it. I played Maple Leaf Rag. Man, everyone went crazy. Got the house, everyone on their feet cheering, and, you know, then afterwards he said, you know, don't ever forget that, you know, don't ever lose that ragtime. That's Jackie Byard talking, so.
Right on. Now, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about jazz education in the classroom versus the jazz education you're talking about, where you're hearing from some of the greats that have, not just talking to you about the music, but about the culture where this music comes from.
Well, you know, jazz school to me is a it can be very tenuous. I think that you have to be very careful about the academization of jazz, because the truth about jazz music is it's really quite simple, and I don't think you need to have years of education in order to play it great. You know, it's really a feeling. I mean, at this stage, in the year 2018, the word has become so fragmented to mean nearly anything that involves improvisation. So whenever I talk about jazz, the kind that I play, I always qualify it by saying New York jazz, just like you have West Coast jazz or New Orleans jazz. I said now the new category should be New York jazz. And what New York jazz to me means is jazz that's come up in the tradition of New York City, which means, of course, Fats Waller and James P., those guys, Bud Powell, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Monk, the bebop guys, and then also the hard bop guys, mm-hmm. Blakey, Jackie McLean, you know, Sonny Clark, Sonny Rollins, and then Miles, and then, of course, everything even in continuous to this day. So, but what is that characteristic that New York jazz has? Well, quite honestly, it's about swinging. I hate it's like a dirty word these days to say it, but you really just got to tip, play good, tasty, melodic phraseology. It's this lost art now where you just play improvised melodies rather than concepts or harmonies. And that's the New York jazz. That's what I always like to play. And it doesn't mean recreating, like I said, like Jackie. You never want to get trapped in this thing like, now we're going to play from this record, this shit. No. Internalize it and express it in your own way, you know, any way you can. You know, so that's my thoughts on it. Music education in a school tends to be, it's a hard thing. It's like yesterday, Anthony and I were having a conversation about the biospheres that they have in the gardens in New York City. So these glass enclosed spheres that contain these different, very, very different environments, rainforest in one, and sure. You know, so it's like jazz now. It's like got to be in a biosphere because the environment doesn't exactly really work for jazz creatures anymore, don't live well in this environment. So they might live in small pockets of environment that still exists. But the beautiful thing that I discovered is that all across this country and indeed all across the world, there are people that really love this music and are willing to organize concerts, clubs. And I say it almost every show that I do now is that the jazz people that you meet in the world are all kind of represent the same ideals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really fascinating thing about this music is the way it can unify through, you know, it really is blind to race, color, sex. It's an invisible art form that enters your mind directly and communicates to you in a way that has nothing to do with language. So it is a worldwide thing.
Love to hear another song from the group in our studios today.
Great. Yeah, this one is a new arrangement on an old classic tune called The Thrill Is Gone. We hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Pianist Spike Willner and his quartet. Joe Magnarelli on the beautiful flugelhorn solo there. That's Paul Gill bass, Anthony Pinciotti drums. Spike, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, we've got our School of Jazz guest DJ coming up, taking over the 8 o'clock hour, a teenager, taking over the radio station 8 o'clock next week. And I love talking to
you
teenagers.
You said teenager?
Yeah.
How old?
17.
Okay.
Yeah, that's still teenager.
Yeah,
and I talk to kids a lot about the next step for them, whether it's to become a professional musician. And in some cases, I try to emphasize the idea of just becoming a musician or becoming an artist. And I think you've had some interesting things to say about that.
Well, I think the idea of a professional musician is, it's like, you know, the environment is not really conducive for such work, although it is possible and most of my friends are these kind of people, but it's not what you may think it is, you know, when you're young. So you can't have any illusions about what it means to be professional. You know, in the old days, and I mean like the 1930s, 40s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, really the golden era of music in New York, you could go down to the local union house and there'd be a big bulletin board of jobs for that day. Mm-hmm. And you could just go in there and pick anyone you wanted out and go if you could do it. Because most of the time at work was playing for dances where you'd be reading out of a very specific book or a chart or some kind of a show. Or, you know, it wasn't like you were going into a jazz club to play your original tunes and stretch out on some cool vamp, you know, take a break, smoke a joint, go back and do it. You know, that. So the idea of what work meant,
right,
I think,
yeah,
has changed. You know, in the old days, and I'm fortunate enough to have had the experience of actually doing some of those real functional kind of jobs in my career, where I was traveling with a touring big band that would be doing dances, real ones,
right,
or working in a hotel. We would, you know, I played many years in a hotel as part of a musical staff in a resort hotel,
yeah,
or you're putting on a tuxedo every night and you're playing 6 hours,
right,
of solo piano a night, you know, and you're smiling and you're not up there like, you know, hunched over in this reverie state playing your, you know, Montuno. It's like you're playing, you know, Misty for the 10 millionth time, or, you know, the theme from whatever, and they're putting things and they want to talk to you while you're playing. You know, I was playing at Arturo's. It's a place in the city where I used to play, and I'm doing this whole, like, what I thought at the time was this amazing solo. And I'm playing, and then this lady comes up to me, and she's smiling, she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her while I'm playing, and she's smiling, and she's looking at me, and I'm thinking, like, wow, she must love this music so much. And then finally she comes up, she goes, where's the restroom? You know? And I was like, okay, you know? But that's that kind of training, actually, that kind of, it's a humility, actually, where you, right. I think, though, also that if you get to the point where you are burned out on doing those kind of jobs and it's become the only way you can subsist, you're in danger of becoming cynical. And then if you enter into that dark realm and that can, it's, you know, you become like in Lord of the Rings, like a shade, one of those, you know, darklings that walks around hating everything.
Right.
So you have to be careful. I was becoming one of those guys in my 30s. I had reached a point, mid-30s, late-30s, and I finally decided, after having, you know, ruining a relationship and losing some friends and stuff, that I had to make a conscientious decision in myself as to how I needed to approach music from this point, because I was not clearly achieving the goal that I needed for myself to feel satisfaction. And fortunately, I had a lot of very good artist friends. And what I mean by artist friends is I mean like the bohemian do or die by art, whether it be poverty or insanity. You know, I was around people like that that were my great teachers and friends. And so I could kind of see, like, you know, you don't need to be famous. You don't need to make any money. You don't need to have any recognition whatsoever from anyone. What you really need to do is get into yourself and find out what you are.
Yeah.
Self-discovery, being brave enough to say, you know what, I don't really want to play that style. I respect it, it's great, but I like this. I'm going to be this. This is what I am. I can do this. And, you know, one time I had the great fortune of working with Tony Bennett. Also, when I was kind of young, he came in to a restaurant where I was playing some solo piano, and we started actually having a friendship where I rehearsed him and went to his house, and it was a nice period of my life where I got to really know the Bennett family, and I'm still close with them, actually. But one time Tony said to me, he said, Spike, I wish I could do his voice, Spike. He's like, if you want to be a genius, just be yourself 100%, because every person is different and unique, and if you can be yourself, then you're going to be unique, which is what a genius is. And I was like, what? Wait a minute. Like, it was so profound. And it came out of the blue, too. He was just, maybe he heard me struggling because I was in a, you know, I had a long period of lack of confidence and ego issues and all the things you go through when you're a developing artist. But it was a very helpful realization to know that you can just take your time to find out who you are. And you have to let go of the trappings of success, you know. And you may even suffer a lot. A lot of guys do, you know. Eventually, with me, what happened is I had the opportunity to become partner at Small's Jazz Club more than 11 years ago. The original creator of Small's Jazz Club is a saintly man named Mitch Borden, who's still my partner to this day. And the club was in danger of being closed, and I had an opportunity to kind of buy in and get involved. And it was a decision that just took me on a... I never imagined. It was never anything that I had planned in my life or anything that I could have imagined. But it has been a fantastic opportunity, an amazing experience. And also, from an artistic point of view, very humbling. You know, like, it really pushed me to the limit of my own belief in myself as an artist. And also, what happened is, in the last 10 years, is that I was able to strip away the nonsense that I carried in from my, you know, music day years, and emerge with this other thing where it was like, you know, it used to be like, if I was sat down to play, I'd be nervous because I was afraid that, oh man, Peter Bernstein's in the audience and he's listening to me, and so I you know, or oh, I suck, that sucked, that was terrible, you know. And now it's like, man, I've been like minding this damn bar for the last 8 hours, you know, stacking glasses, washing dishes, paying bills, dealing with the attorneys, taxes, payroll, booking artists, landlord who's insane, you know, neighborhood community groups fight, you know. By the time I get to the piano, I'm like, oh,
thank God,
you know, like, Caligon, save me. And finally, just like soak in a nice hot pool of bebop, you know, with my best friends, it's like the greatest thing in the world. So that's the realization of just gratitude for playing music is a big one.
Now, I know Seattle is several years behind New York as far as the increasing rents go, but not only Smalls, but Mesro and Greenwich Village are your clubs, and I wonder how you're dealing with the increased rent situations and how it's getting tougher and tougher for artists to live in a big city.
Yeah, it's very scary. It's nearly impossible. I don't know what to say on that.
You kind of have worked in a kind of a nonprofit model for your business, too, kind of subscriptions to smallslive.com.
Well, one of my missions since I took over the club in 2007 was to try to document every show that's been there. I feel like the work that takes place there night after night is of historic importance and will one day represent a treasure trove of, music for future scholars, maybe 100 years in the future, or aliens when they take over, who knows. But, so I started with a simple kind of recording device, and then we started also doing, before really most people, although I did get the idea from the guy that ran the original knitting factory, to try to do a live video stream. And that became very popular quickly. So I soon kind of implemented the system of the live stream and the archive kind of every night. So now, fast forward 11 years later, I have about 17,000 recordings in my archive, which I've organized onto a database that we have on the Amazon S3 server, and a website where you can search any date or musician or instrument and find exactly when they played, who they are, bios, photos, and then, of course, the audio and video of that night. But what we built into the system was this idea of one of the things that we think about a lot is the unfairness of the current revenue from streaming models such as Spotify or Apple Music. So we were trying to think of like a way to pay out royalty to the artist that would be the most fair. We tried to come up with the most fair artistically minded situation we could, and that's what Smalls Live became. So we record everything, but the artists own the masters. That's theirs to do with as they please. They own the publishing. Mm-hmm. We have no ownership to the intellectual property of that recording. The only thing we ask is that we can keep a copy in our library, which the artist can then either make it private, which means no one can see it but himself, or which he can do it as much, or he can publish it. If it's published, that means that Smalls Live supporting members, which is what we call them, they're people who are paying a monthly donation, have access to this archive. So the idea is that we pool all the revenue from the memberships, and then we have a system that monitors the usage of the archive so that you see which, as an artist is listening to, let's say it's a Spike Willner Quartet in the archive and Joe Magnarelli is in the band, and you listen to the show for 10 minutes, say, Joe will get a 10-minute credit to his name, as will I and Paul and Anthony. So after the end of a pay period, you'll have a total archive usage minutes, and then you'll have each artist with their own individual minutes. That becomes divided to create a ratio, and that becomes their portion of the payout pool.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done this a few times now, and we're about to have our third payout in the history of Smalls Live. We'll start this will be for the period of 2017, and we're going to distribute about $14,000 to the artists. We have about 300-something artists in our archive, and it's very interesting to see like who the most popular artist to the least popular artist, because we work it out, so it's transparent. You can get the spreadsheet. You can see how many minutes. But I can say that's fascinating about the system is that the top guys in the top, say, 10 or 20 part of the payout are going to see like $300 or $400 in royalty payments, which is amazing. Far more than you would get from, they'll get fractions of a cent,
Right.
So that's been a successful thing. We're trying to turn it into a non-for-profit organization where people can simply become members, tax-deductible memberships, and then it supports the artists and the archives. So that's been our overriding goal. It's been a lot of work.
Sounds like it's paying off for the artists.
Well, I think it's still yet burgeoning.
Yeah.
It's still in its nascency because it's I still have to get everyone on board. But we're about to redo the website, and we'll see. But back to your thing about the rent, the rents in New York have become so high as to create urban blight. Like, it's a bizarre situation where it's not poverty, but excessive wealth are destroying neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there was a cafe space right across the street from Smalls called the Riviera Cafe. Been there for 100 years.
Yeah.
Went out of business, and now the space sits empty. An enormous cafe space, outdoor seating, downstairs club area. So my partner and I decided to just have a tour of it and see what the rent was. They were asking $41,000 a month.
Oh. So it's cheaper to keep it empty.
I guess so.
That's amazing.
I mean, and I'm just sitting there going, as a guy who runs a business in the neighborhood, I'm thinking $41,000 a month. And if you take a tour of Greenwich Village now, and that you'll see about 50% of the stores are shuttered. You know, it's really become this thing. What used to be diners and bookstores and cool little cafes is just empty. And I fear that fate for Smalls, quite honestly, because my landlord is a criminal, you know, and so it's like you can't, you know, there's no compassion. You have to just figure out some kind of deal that'll make them happy, which just means money, basically. Yeah. So give them money and they like it.
Take notes, Seattle.
Yeah.
And hey, everybody out there, check out smallslive.com and become a member and check out the archives. Spike, we've got time for one more song. What would you like to finish with today?
Okay, thank you. We're going to play a very pretty piece co-composed by Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. And it's from a suite that he dedicated to Queen Elizabeth back in his day as a romantic gesture. He called it the Queen's Suite, and he recorded only two copies, one which he gave to the Queen and the other which he kept in a vault with the instructions that no one was to listen to it until after his death. And then after he died, they got that record out, and they turned out to be one of his greatest masterpieces, actually. So incredible thing. So this is one of the songs from the Queen's Suite, and this one is a French title called Sucré Velours, which means the sweet velvet. Hope you enjoy.